Okay. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Eric Hoffman. I'm lecturer in politics at the University of Southampton, and I'm chairing this conference on majority groups and dominant minorities. I'd like to welcome you all here to the LSE. This event is hosted by ASEN, the Association for the Study of Ethnicity and Nationalism, also based here at LSE. In addition, I'd like to acknowledge the financial support of the Economic and Social Research Council and the British Academy, without which this event could not take place. Finally, on a somewhat sadder note, Andreas Wimmer, who was supposed to be here today, has had a medical emergency in his family, and so he will not be able to attend, so we had to withdraw him from the program. Although I know he was very much looking forward to giving his paper, we wish him all the best, and I also look forward to seeing his paper in a book that I'm editing based on this conference theme for Routledge. In any event, this has led to a change in the program, so there will be a change from the programs that you've seen, and a revised program is inserted in your conference pack. So if you want to use that as the program, thanks. Okay. Right. As I pursued my postgraduate work here at the LSE on the decline of dominant ethnicity in the United States, I was struck by the fact that dominant ethnicity and its study occupied or seemed to occupy a blind spot in the literature. And this holds both for the American literature, which is influenced by the work of theorists, originally influenced by the work of theorists like Robert Park, and tends to focus on urban ethnic minorities and their identity politics and incorporation into host societies. With few exceptions, the so-called host society is never scrutinized in detail. European scholarship, though hitting perhaps somewhat closer to the mark, has similarly bypassed the question of dominant ethnicity. This tradition, exemplified in the work of, for example, Ernest Gellner or Eric Hobsbawm, focuses on two major themes, the first being the rise of a kind of state nationalism out of upon a dynastic or absolutist base. And this is often traced to military, industrial, bureaucratic, and educational revolutions of the late 18th and early 19th centuries. Second, an examination following on from this, there was an examination of minority nationalism as a response to this kind of centralizing state nationalism, or to subsequent centralizing drives by the state. Now, these two themes, therefore, the state nationalism and the response, the ethnic national response to this, are the major components of the European tradition. There are occasional references to Staatsvolk or Herrenvolk democracy, but by and large, dominant ethnic and nation remain undifferentiated. It seems that only in those states where power is seriously contested, that is, where dominance is up for grabs in a way, that are all ethnic groups treated as, in a sense, similar phenomena. And it is in this context that we can understand Schermerhorn's pioneering use of the terms dominant majority and dominant elite, which he developed around 1970. But today we live in an age where equality of cultural respect seems a theme, a leitmotif of Western culture. And this sits very oddly and uneasily with the idea of ethnic nationalism and ethnic dominance, and so leads nation-state elites, and as we'll see, even minority nationalists at the sub-state level, to try and couch their claims in the inclusive civic language of republicanism or multiculturalism. And so nation and dominant ethnia are increasingly coming apart, I would assert, in the West. Indeed, my wider belief is that the nation always was, in a sense, a field created by the interaction between the dominant ethnic group on the one hand, and on the other hand, a state elite. And what we witness as either civic or ethnic nationalism tends to reflect the balance of power or coincidence of goals between the dominant ethnic and the state elite. And just to illustrate the above, I've prepared about four slides, very short number of slides here, which I'd like to show you before I return to my presentation. let's hope this works. Okay. Just in the first slide, all I've done is drawn up a little diagram to show you the way I conceive of things in the pre-modern period before the rise of nation-states, before the late 18th century. We can think of the dominant ethnic and various forms of polity as being separate in many ways. Now, we may have had dominant ethnies like the Turks, for example, the Anatolian Turks, for example, controlling an empire like the Ottoman Empire, but they didn't try to impose their self-conception on that society. However, as we move into the modern period, under the influence of nationalist ideas and the various modernizing revolutions that I mentioned, dominant ethnic groups, the dominant ethnic group here and the state are in a sense forced together. There's a coincidence of interest between dominant ethnic group and the state, which comes together as a compromise called the ethnic nation. And so what we're seeing here is that the dominant ethnic group is enmeshed within the nation state, and hence has quite a bit of power. Now there is space for dissent here, and we can see in this blue section it's supposed to represent areas where the state elite is in some sense in tension with the dominant ethnic group. And if we think of a few examples, for example, the pro and anti-Dreyfus factions in turn of the century France, pro and anti-immigration factions in the United States, say, between 1880 and 1925, these are two cases where there was tension between the so-called ethnic and civic factions within the state. Now, what I'm asserting is that in the West, what's happened very recently in the post-industrial period is that these norms of cultural equality that I've talked about are driving a wedge between the dominant ethnic group and the state, and that the nation is increasingly being defined by the state. The dominant ethnic group is becoming more visible. It's becoming less powerful because, as we can see, the scope for ethnic nationalism is being squeezed out. But it is becoming more visible as it's forced to leave the state and the whole nationalist project. Now, perhaps a less clear-cut phenomenon outside of the West, a different phenomenon, perhaps. I've tried to represent it graphically. It may not work. The shrinking, to some extent, of the state due to a weakening of the Cold War boundaries, due to a weakening of unity forged during the colonial struggle, and the fragmentation of the state due to norms of national self-determination, has, I think, exposed the dominant ethnie much more than it has in the past. So if you think of, for example, Nehru's India, or Nkrumah's Ghana, or Tito's Yugoslavia, these were states that had some kind of a state-national ideology which has collapsed. And dominant ethnicity has in many ways filled that vacuum. And the Ashanti in Ghana, or the Serbs in Yugoslavia, or the Hindus in India perhaps are examples of where you can see dominant ethnicity rising to fill this vacuum, if you like. Right. Now, if we just go back here, in our first session today, first and second session, Steve Bruce, Theodore Wright, and Danielle Juteau will be examining the ways in which dominant ethnicity has been or is being pressured in some sense out of its former home in the state or the state nationalist project, as in Britain or the U.S., or even within the sub-state nationalist project of Quebec. Theodore Wright also alerts us to the plethora of formerly dominant ethnic minorities, including the American Wasps, Mohajirs, and Afrikaners. The second session considers a range of cases where the opposite situation appears to hold, namely that of the resurgence of dominant ethnicity. Anthony Smith outlines the many symbolic connections that bind dominant ethnies to modern nation states. Chetan Bhatt examines Hindu dominant ethnicity in India and in the diaspora. In effect, dominant ethnicity flourishes even amongst ethnic minorities who are themselves the subject of exclusion. And our final seminar will concentrate on the Israeli case, which exhibits aspects of both dominant ethnic resurgence and transcendence. Oren Yiftekel charts the incremental growth of Jewish dominance in Israel as the state institutions deepen and consolidate there. On the other hand, Yaakov Yadgar catalogs the countertrend of post-Zionism and its impact upon Israeli nationalist discourse. And we'll try to see where these two currents interconnect. So it appears that some of the strands of post-nationalism that I've been talking about over there have a loose counterpart in Israel as well. All of which suggests that dominant ethnicity is, in my mind, a very diverse and ubiquitous phenomenon. I don't think it's going too far to say that almost every group at some point in its history, in some place, has been dominant. I've also tried to highlight a range of cases of dominant ethnicity that show this diversity. So we have dominant ethnic groups as majorities, such as the English in Britain or Jews of Israel. We have minority dominant groups, such as the Anglo-Saxon Protestants of the United States in the 20th century. Ethnic groups can be dominant within the state, like the Hindus of India, but they can also all be dominant within a sub-state homeland region, such as the Pyrenean French Canadians in Quebec. They may also be formerly dominant, like the Mohajirs of India. And finally, dominant ethnicity can draw strength from the diaspora, as with the Jews or Hindus. It's also important, I think, to recognize that not all cases exhibit dominance across all functional and structural dimensions. So, for example, not all dominant ethnic groups are hegemonic over the economy, the political structure, demographically and culturally. And if we only have to think of South Africa, for example, where the Afrikaners were politically powerful, but the economic purse strings were held by the English, and demographically, the pan-ethnic Bantu groups were the largest. In Jordan, another case where the Palestinians are the largest demographically, but on the other hand, have little access to political power, and that situation occurs in many states. Structurally, different class or status fractions may be carrying forth the dominant ethnic crusade or enforcing hegemony. In the past, often this has been the bureaucratic, military, or clerical elite. But today, in many cases, and Oren Yiftecha will point this out, for example, in settler societies like Israel or the U.S., it's the lower status groups that are the most vociferous defenders of dominant ethnicity. And the same, I know, has been noted for far-right parties in Europe. So we have to be sensitive to the form of dominance and also to the class fraction that is its major champion. Now, finally, this conference is tending to consider the empirical manifestations of dominant ethnicity. But there is lurking behind this perhaps another question, the normative question of the legitimacy, perhaps, of dominant ethnic groups. We could ask the question, is any form of dominant ethnicity, even cultural or demographic, legitimate? And if not, should we say, therefore, that ethnicity needs to detach itself from territory? And this is quite a radical idea, some have proposed it. But we have to also ask the question, what does this imply for the longer-term future of ethnic diversity? And these are obviously very difficult questions as well. But anyhow, this brings me to the end of my introduction, and I'd like now to introduce Steve Bruce, who is professor of sociology at the University of Aberdeen in Scotland. And he's the author of 16 books on the sociology of religion and politics, and terrorism, some of which are listed in his biographical note in the abstracts, which are in your conference folder. His recent works include Fundamentalism, published by Polity in 2001, as well as God is Dead, Secularization in the West, published by Blackwell in 2002. And his latest book, Politics and Religion, will be published by Polity Press in 2003. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm just waiting for Eric to set up the PowerPoint display. The acoustics in this room are terrible at this end. Can you all hear me? The only thing I can hear is the sound of the cooling fan on the projector. Great. Could you slide it a bit closer so I can reach it with my left hand? And then I won't have to move. I don't need the mouse.
Oh, you're on the mouse.
The wonders of modern technology. The problem with these PowerPoint displays is you start off writing a wonderfully erudite essay that's got lots of interesting, sparkling historical anecdotes and quotations in it, and it seems terribly scholarly. And then you try and boil it down to 30 points that you can talk about in 25 minutes, and once you remove all the sophistication, you realize you're saying something utterly banal and trite and just glaringly obvious, which actually I could say in 2 minutes, but that wouldn't fill the time. So I'm gonna wander about a bit. The point is very simple, though. And I want to start by, as I started to write this, it became very obvious to me that there's two ways in which a dominant ethnic group can lose its position. The people themselves can lose their position, and this seems to be the case of the Afrikaners in South Africa or the Ulster Protestants in Northern Ireland. That is, a particular group of people are actually displaced. But my remit was to think about the role of Protestantism in Britain. There you have something very different. The people themselves have not been displaced. What has happened is they've abandoned what used to be a defining characteristic. Same people are there, they just no longer believe the things they used to believe. They're no longer defined by the same things. To make sense of this potted history, and it is very potted, I need to start by telling you something about the religious composition of Great Britain. And I'll start with England, the biggest part of this. The Reformation in England was at best partial. Henry removed the English church from the control of Rome and in that sense made it Protestant, but he left it Episcopalian. It still has archbishops and bishops. It was only ever half Protestant in doctrine. Large elements of Catholic thinking remained, and it's always been extremely varied in ritual. There are some Church of England parishes that are almost Catholic, and there are some that are almost Methodist at the other end. So there's that complexity, and then you have a whole series of big waves of dissent. Large numbers of people leave the Church of England so that, and it's a convenient point, by 1851, of those people who went to church in October 1851, more than half of them did not go to the Church of England. They went to something else, the Methodists and the Baptists primarily. Scotland, further complexity. I mean, Scotland itself was different from England in that Scotland was affected by the Reformation. In Scotland, Protestantism became the popular faith. But it happened in waves, so that Scotland itself was internally divided. The lowlands of Scotland became Protestant. The highlands of Scotland remained Roman Catholic for a long time after the lowlands had gone Protestant. And then, just to spite them, by the time the highlands got round to the Reformation and became gung-ho Calvinists, the lowlanders had largely given up religion and were secular. So the two parts of Scotland remained out of step. And then there's a further complexity that the state church itself, being Presbyterian, and I'll come back to this, they kept splitting every 50 years. They split so that at one point there were seven organizations all claiming to be the Presbyterian Church of Scotland. And finally, you have a large number of Catholics. Middle of the 19th century onwards, large numbers of Catholics settle in the lowland. But, and this is an interesting point, not all of the Irish who settled in Scotland were Roman Catholic. About a third of them were Ulster Protestants who brought with them their traditions of organized anti-Catholicism. So in Scotland, even more diversity. In Wales, we have, as for England, the same semi-Protestant state church, but dissent, nonconformity, was far more popular in Wales than it was in England. So that by the middle of the 19th century, the majority of Welsh people were not actually members of their supposed state church, so you have lots of arguments about disestablishing the state church. I'm leaving Ireland out of this quite deliberately, although it appears, in the longer version of this talk, it appears as an important consideration. So we have a great deal of diversity. But nonetheless, the British managed to find some degree of unity in a kind of popularized, not very theological version of evangelical Protestantism. The Scottish Presbyterians, the Welsh Methodists and Baptists, the English nonconformists, and about half of the Church of England, the low end of the Church of England, could subscribe to this idea that the British were Protestants. I mention this only in passing. Christians the world over have had a tendency to think of themselves as being metaphorically the children of Israel. especially when they're in small numbers and feel themselves be persecuted, they call on the imagery of the Old Testament. There has also been, though, an organized British Israelite movement which goes beyond metaphor and claims that the British are actually the children of Israel. I mean, we're not just like the children of Israel, actually we are the children of Israel. People have claimed that the British, sometimes that's been broadened to all Anglo-Saxons, sometimes that's been broadened to all Northern Europeans, basically anyone with fair hair, that we are actually the children of Israel, descended from the 10 northern tribes of Israel that disappeared from the historical record halfway through the Old Testament. I have to say, British Israelism has not been terribly influential. Organized British Israelite movements have always been very small. At the moment, its main instance is in the kind of Christian Patriot and Aryan movements that you find in parts of the extreme right wing in the United States. In Britain, that kind of we are the children of Israel thinking was much less common and much less influential than just a vague association of religion, national character, and fate, the success of the British. I think it works something like this. The British claimed for themselves a variety of virtues. They saw themselves as being particularly hardworking and diligent, as independent of spirit. You couldn't push us around easily. We were independent of spirit. But when we were persuaded of the rectitude of some cause, then boy, were we loyal. We were loyal and dependable. Third, that the literate, I mean, Protestants made great fuss about the fact that to be a Protestant was to be literate and educated, and somehow that was a precondition for political autonomy. But at the same time, never intellectual and certainly not artistic. I mean, the British did not like intellect. I once tried, when I was filling in a passport form where it says occupation, I decided to be French and I put intellectual on my passport application. And the woman in the passport office in Glasgow just stared at me and says, "Aye, but what do you do for a living, son?" So we can't be intellectuals. And that we're, of course, reliable and temperate. What's the implied contrast? Well, the implied contrast is that foreigners, and for most of the 18th, 19th, and 20th century, foreigners here has meant the Irish, our nearest instance of these vices. Foreigners are slothful and feckless. They sit around. They do nothing except periodically gamble. They're dishonest and treacherous. They're drunken. They're illiterate. And they're priest-ridden. They don't have the kind of independence of spirit that characterizes us. Unless, of course, they're rich, in which case they're foppish, dilettante, and artistic, and probably homosexual as well. So we have this model that kind of the British are particularly virtuous, the roast beef of old England. Why are we virtuous? Well, this isn't an accident. We are virtuous because we have the right religion. And there are elements of historical accuracy in this. I mean, I think one can construct a plausible story that connects the Reformation to the rise of liberal democracy through the importance of things like the promotion of literacy. I mean, I don't think these stereotypes are entirely without foundation, but their foundations aren't terribly important to the people who believe in them, of course. And foreigners, again, especially the Irish, well, they've got problems because they've got the wrong religion. How did these stereotypes become popular? Well, really for two reasons. They became popular, of course, because most of the modern history of Britain involves struggles between Protestants and Catholics, or Protestants and non-Protestants, the Reformation itself, the parliamentary civil wars, various of the internal wars in Scotland and between Scotland and England. And people used those stereotypes in their self-images developed during those wars. But I'm sure, more importantly, the external wars. I mean, for most of its recent history, Britain has been at war with competing imperial powers who just happen to be Catholic. Spain and France, and of course our perpetual war with Ireland. This slide I've called Embedding Religio-Ethnic Identity, and this is, I'm interested in how these stereotypes become part of popular culture. But of course, the churches themselves played a major part in this, churches and missionary organizations, and all the kind of peripheral organizations that churches promoted, especially during the 19th century. We have the Boys Brigade, we have the, later on, we have the Scouts, the Cubs, other kinds of uniformed organizations. The churches themselves promoted a great range of social activities, associations, and so on. We have very specific organizations that were in the business of promoting this religio-ethnic identity, primarily the Orange Order. We have schools themselves. If you look back at the kinds of books that were given as school prizes in the 19th century, you see constantly these kinds of themes appearing in the sort of literature that was regarded as suitable for young people. And I think this is probably not considered often enough. It's worth recalling that most of the organizations that played a major part in civilizing industrial Britain, the kinds of people who passed the Factories Act, the kind of people who stopped women and children being stuffed down coal mines, the kinds of people who banned slavery, an awful lot of the reform organizations of modern Britain were led by evangelical Protestants. And as part of their reform, underlying was the kind of, you know, we are Protestants, we are good people, hence we shouldn't be putting children down the pits. But we lost it. Trying to date exactly when British identity starts to become secularized is not easy. I don't think you can do it accurately. My guess is that the high point of this association of a popular Protestantism with a sense of what it is to be British, that the high point coincides with the high point of the empire. That you'd want to put it somewhere between the coronation of Victoria as Empress of India in 1876 and the start of the First World War in 1914. It was certainly well in decline by the 1920s. And I don't think it's an accident that some of the major figures who are represented in popular school literature as exemplifying the Protestant British spirit are people associated with the empire. Chinese Gordon, David Livingstone, John Buchan were the three that came to mind when I was typing that slide. But already a change is underway. And I will, in the long version of the essay, I discuss a number of different illustrations of this change. For this purpose, I'll concentrate simply on the Conservative Party. The Conservative Party, by the third quarter of the 19th century, had already spotted which way the wind was blowing. And you see it very clearly in the Primrose League. The Primrose League was set up by Conservatives. It always pretended to be something other than the Conservative Party. In fact, it was the popular wing of the Conservative Party. It was set up to recruit people who were going to be able to vote for the first time. The big change underlying the establishment of the Primrose League was the extension of the franchise. And of course, I mean, Eric alluded to this in passing. Once you give the majority of people the vote, then you have to start worrying about what they think about things. Before that, you needn't worry. Now you have to worry about what they think about things. You have to make sure they think the right way. The Primrose League was interesting in that it very deliberately went out of its way to recruit Catholics and dissenters, Methodists, people who were not members of the Church of England, and Jews. It very deliberately tried to promote a conservative British identity which was not even Christian, which rather avoided religion. Of course, particular branches of the Primrose League didn't catch on to this message too easily, but nonetheless, the organization nationally tried very hard to build a British identity that did not rest on religion. And very self-consciously, it avoided the Orange Order. It avoided being associated with other organizations that stressed religio-ethnic identity. You can also, I think, very clearly trace the declining importance of religion if you simply look at the biographies of Conservative Party leaders over the 20th century. I have yet to do some investigation. It's actually remarkably hard to find out the personal faith of some individuals. I suspect that means they didn't have any. But nonetheless, there are a few people. I mean, Anthony Eden, for example, I have managed to find nothing at all about Anthony Eden's personal religious beliefs. I'm sure there are people in this room who can help me. But I'm also convinced that that Andrew Bonar Law, who was the Tory party leader from 1911 to 1921, that Bonar Law was probably the last British Conservative leader who really believed in the United Kingdom, who had some kind of romantic and sentimental attachment to the idea of the United Kingdom as an organic body defined by its religion. Interestingly, he was a Canadian. I'm not sure what that says. You can run through the Tory party leaders. You find Winston Churchill, who would routinely say generally pious things about Christianity and positive things about revealed religion, but would never commit himself to supporting any particular revealed religion against any other. And by the time you get to Margaret Thatcher, you find someone who has no interest whatsoever in religion, who has no interest whatsoever in being British, and whose conservatism is almost entirely economic liberalism combined with a vague dislike for foreigners. But that dislike for foreigners has now got nothing to do with the fact they're Roman Catholics, they're just foreigners. And of course, if you look at the extreme right of British politics now, you find, for example, that the British National Party makes nothing at all of religion. Well, it makes one thing of religion, which I'll come to. This is the British National Party's official position. The BNP takes no particular religious position. The BNP would preserve the long British tradition of separating church and state. The dangers facing the British people are so great that it would be crass criminality to allow our people and country to be divided along religious lines. We have to save our country first. I also looked at the UK Referendum Party, a good example, I think, of the Little Englander. And again, no mention anywhere in any of their programs of any notion that British identity has a religious component to it. And, I mean, one doesn't want to entirely personalize politics, but I thought it was worth mentioning that Sir James Goldsmith, the bankroller of the Referendum Party, himself was an ex-Jew who, as far as I can tell, had no personal faith of any sort, and his daughter is now a Muslim, having converted on marrying the Pakistani cricketer Imran Khan. The extreme right of British politics does not do religion. He was Jewish. He was Jewish. He was born Jewish. I don't think he ever did anything Jewish in his life, but pursued. Okay, if we can accept as a general, I mean, this is glossing history, this is history simplified, that once upon a time, despite its internal divisions, a popularized evangelical Protestantism was an important element of British national identity, a sense of who the British are and why their empire was good and why they were justified in having one. And we also accept that over the 20th century this largely disappears, so that now very, very few advocates of British identity try and incorporate religion in it. Then we have a change to explain. How do we explain the secularization of national identity? Well, obviously, an important part of the background, the first thing I've said on this slide, is that we're talking about a period in which the Western world becomes secularized generally. Religion declined in power, prestige, and popularity across most of the Western world. It did so first in Britain. Obviously, I'm not going to try and explain secularization here. You can read all about it in the wonderful God is Dead, Secularization in the West, an excellent book, widely available from good bookshops, including the one downstairs. And I'll pass on to those things that, in a sense, are highlighted by the British circumstance. My theory of secularization supposes that there are features of modern societies which undermine religion, which weaken the power of religion. However, there's nothing inevitable about the decline of religion, because there are also powerful forces which keep religion at the center of national life and which allow religion to retain popularity, power, and prestige. And most of the counter-secularizing tendencies, I think, can be summarized as what I've called cultural defense. Religion tends to remain important if It is an important part of the identity of a group of people who feel themselves under threat, especially if they are under threat from a group of people of a different religion. Let me put it as specifically as that. So why does religion decline in the UK? Well, I think this is what I meant by saying this paper starts to sound glaringly obvious. It also starts to sound tautologous. I think the explanation is that the necessary conditions for religion to acquire or retain the cultural defense role were largely absent from the United Kingdom. What are those necessary conditions? Well, I think the first point is crucial. A great deal of whether religion retains an important part in people's identity depends on the extent to which there is conflict and the nature of that conflict. And what I've said, my first point, is that periodic panics aside, and there were panics, I mean, especially the French Revolution, the Jacobite rebellions in Scotland in 1715 and 1745, you get these periodic panics which provoke an upsurge of interest in people campaigning to defend church and king. But those apart, the British state has actually been remarkably strong and stable. It hasn't been greatly threatened. Second point, and this is brought to my mind not so much by European examples, although we could find some, but more by examples from the Third World of failed secular nationalisms. It seems to me one of the crucial things that any government is required to do is to protect its people and to improve their lives, their livelihood. Insofar as governments are effective in doing this, then there is less pressure on them to provide ideological legitimations. Or to put it another way, I don't think it's a coincidence that states such as Pakistan and many African countries, as they have failed as governments, so their political leaders have become keener on finding religious legitimations for their leadership. We may not be very good at governing. In fact, we may be completely useless at governing. We may be a bunch of kleptomaniacs, but by God, we have religion on our side. You know, we are the representatives of our historical religion. For that reason, you should support us. British governments were actually very effective. But the main problem, and this is what I meant by saying my talk is glaringly obvious, I think the main problem is internal diversity. If religion is going to play a major part in national identity, then it helps if the people who form the nation have the same religion. It's obvious. It works well for the Poles. I mean, the Poles have been so uniformly Catholic for so long that, I mean, it's a well-known Polish slogan, Catholic Pole, to say someone is, well, it's actually the other way around, Pole Catholic. To say someone is a Pole is to say they're a Catholic. Apart from 2 months after the Westminster Assembly in the middle of the 17th century, there were 2 months in which Britain had a single state church. That was all. The English then reneged on the deal with the Scots and went back to their old ways. And Britain went back to having a fragmented religious establishment. Britain doesn't have a single state church. It has had a number of state churches which are all different. Second point, I think this one is crucial, I'll return to it. Protestant churches fragment. It is the essence of Protestantism to split. It isn't an accident. It is the very essence of Protestantism to split. Once you accept the basic Protestant idea that each of us is able to discern God's will on our own, that we do not need a priesthood, we do not need an organized hierarchy, we do not need the Vatican's office of the truth to tell us what we should believe. Once you accept that all of us can discern God's will on our own, you have a recipe for constant schism, and this is what happens in the Protestant world. Protestant churches keep splitting. So we don't have a common Protestant culture. We have a variety of competing Protestant organizations. And of course, we have an increasing Roman Catholic population, which then puts the ruling elites in an awkward position. What do they do about this? You have a choice. Do you try and maintain religio-ethnic purity, Or do you accept that to do that will create a great deal of social conflict? And the remarkable thing is how quickly elites in Britain realize that they cannot promote a single dominant religio-ethnic identity, and that social harmony requires that they gradually dilute religion and then abandon it altogether. I mean, I can offer you many, many examples, but I'll offer you two which just strike me as revealing. The first concerns Sir John Gilmore. Sir John Gilmore was a leading conservative in Scotland. He was the Secretary of State for Scotland twice in his career. He was also a leading member of the Orange Order, an organization set up to promote Protestant religio-ethnic identity, to promote the argument that Protestantism is vital to defending our political interests. As Secretary of State for Scotland, John Gilmore was faced with a quite influential campaign by leading Church of Scotland ministers to ban the Irish from Scotland. They wanted an end to Irish immigration. In their more fanciful hours, they wanted to repatriate the Irish, although I think even they realized that that wasn't a goer. And they wanted preferential employment policies. They wanted Protestant jobs to be given to Protestant people. So John Gilmore, leading Orangeman, was faced with a delegation from these people, and he just said no. He said, sorry, you can't have it. He managed to produce the wonderful argument that you couldn't stop Irish immigration because the Irish were not foreigners at all, because the Irish Free State was actually was a dominion within the British Empire. And so they were actually people like us. So here we have a leading Orangeman who half his time is supposed to think the Irish and Roman Catholic Irish are dreadful people, and the other half his time telling Church of Scotland ministers he can't ban them because they're people like us. Second example from Scotland. The Scottish churches handed their schools over to the state in the 1870s because they accepted that there had to be a national system of education, that the churches couldn't provide education. At that point, the Catholic Church did not hand over its schools because it feared the loss of control. And eventually, the Scottish ruling classes gave in. And the 1918 Education Act offered the Catholic Church in Scotland a very favorable deal. Basically, the state would take over the costs of their schools, it would fund Catholic schools, but the Catholic Church would remain in sole control of the ethos of the school and the appointment of staff. The Catholic Church actually got a far better deal than the Scottish Presbyterian churches had been given 40 years earlier. There was a popular outcry again. A number of candidates stood in local elections claiming this was Rome on the rates, that the Roman Catholics were being given a great privilege here. Now, the interesting thing is the Church of Scotland did not support those campaigns. The Church of Scotland, although it had got the worst deal, quite happily acquiesced in the state funding of Roman Catholic schools, and it did so because the leading ministers of the Church of Scotland were persuaded that social harmony required it. That there was a real problem with the quality of education among working class Catholics, and the state ought to pay. There was no opposition. What religion? This brings me back to my point about the essentially the fissiparous nature of Protestantism, the schismatic nature of Protestantism, far easier to pronounce. I don't want to go in this any detail. I mean, I think you can describe religions in terms of the extent to which they are communal or individualistic. Seems to be very clear if you look at the record, for example, of opposing communism in Eastern Europe, that is those communal religions, in particular Catholicism, which has most successfully acted as a guarantor of national identity. Protestants are not very good at this. They're not very good at this because they keep splitting. It seems to me, I can think of only two cases in which Protestants have successfully managed to sustain a communal identity and not constantly split amongst themselves. And both of those examples are unusual in they involve Calvinist Protestants, not any kind of Protestant, Calvinists. And I could talk later about why Calvinists. And secondly, Calvinist Protestants in a small minority who are beleaguered who are very obviously threatened by external forces. But that's an unusual combination. Left to their own devices, Protestants spend all their time splitting. And I just thought it was worth reminding you of this. At the same time as some people were trying to promote a shared evangelical Protestant identity for Britain, the British, we are Protestants, at the same time, the major Protestant churches were tearing themselves apart. In England, you had, right through the 18th and 19th century, contentious battles between the Church of England and nonconformists about the rights of people who were not members of the Church of England. In the 19th century in Wales, you had bitter arguments about state establishment. Why should we Methodists be paying taxes to support a church we do not worship? And almost worse, in Scotland, although there was no great argument of principle, there was an extremely painful legal battle that lasted the best part of 50 years between the Church of Scotland and the breakaway Free Church of Scotland about who owned the property. Towns and villages and congregations were split and set against each other, arguing about who owned the buildings, who gets the bank accounts. But in addition to this propensity to schism, I've already suggested it's the cause of the propensity to schism, you have rampant individualism. At the heart of Protestantism is the notion that the individual is the primary unit. Originally, that individualism concerns responsibilities rather than rights. Individuals are each responsible for their salvational fate. But once you let that particular cat out of the bag, you cannot stuff it back in. And gradually, individualism of responsibility becomes individualism of rights. Now, if you're going to argue that every individual has an equal right to worship as they wish, then that voluntary principle starts to pervade everything. It's very hard to sustain a group identity and to sustain discriminatory policies against some other group when you're going around stressing voluntary principle, the rights of the individual all the time. And they find it very hard, and eventually they give it up. And the last desperate attempt of Protestants to remain anti-Catholic rests on this interesting idea. Okay, we're in favor of toleration. Everyone ought to be able to practice their own religion, but Catholics are still bad. Why are Catholics bad? Well, because Catholics are anti-democratic. If we allow the Catholic Church to prevail, it will undermine democratic rights. Now, there's a lot of truth to that. I mean, the Roman Catholic Church has embraced political democracy very, very late in its life and only reluctantly. The problem is nobody was much persuaded by this because we come back to threat. This argument is going on inside a stable country with no great threat, at least no great threat from Catholics anymore. The claim that somehow papal aggression, that Roman Catholics would undermine British liberties, became implausible. End result, it's a simple point. Where you get a great deal of diversity, the ruling elites have to choose. What do you put first? Religio-ethnic propriety? Do you maintain the faith, or do you maintain social harmony? Do you put the absence of conflict first? I think there are particular features of Protestantism which make it very poor at group identities. And it's a combination of those two things which explain why, faced with an increasingly diverse religious culture, those with power and influence abandoned religion in the search for wider bases of shared identity. Thank you.
A coffee break now. If you could save your questions till after the next session for the discussion. So we'll just go to coffee.
Thank you.
Yeah, and we'll reconvene at 11:15. Thanks.